so nice.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides with the Naturalist Program. We're back for another few recordings. And what we're going to do this morning is I'm going to introduce first my co-host this morning is Carol Butler, who was on our other show on bats and butterflies. And she's making a return appearance here by popular demand in downtown Bushwick. So we're going to do a show today. And the first show is called Dangerous Plants.
Sounds very dangerous.
Sounds very ominous. Some of these plants are really nasty. So we're going to talk about dangerous plants and methods that plants use for survival and how evolution, of course, drives everything in the natural world. So, Carol, do you have any questions about dangerous plants, why we're going to do this today?
Well, I'm sure there's a whole range of dangerous plants. What are the smallest ones? Maybe we can take them in size order.
Yes, we're going to do it in size order. So the first plant we're going to talk about is the smallest plant in the world, and they're called bacteria. Now, many bacteria do photosynthesis, which we'll talk about later. So if you all remember way back in school in ninth grade science or 10th grade science about photosynthesis,
has something to do with chlorophyll.
Right, and something to do with sunlight.
Right.
So the first critter I'm going to talk about, they're called cyanobacteria or blue-green algae. And you may never have heard these terms before, but almost everybody has seen them, and you probably didn't know that you've seen them. They are all over the earth, but the easiest place to see them are in water bodies. If you have a water body that looks polluted or looks very still, like a swamp.
Like stagnant?
Stagnant is the word. That's the word, Carol, right. And it has a green scum on it. That's cyanobacteria, or an algae mat. Now, they look very innocuous, these bacteria. And if you think about bacteria, most bacteria are pretty, they're not harmful. But these cyanobacteria can cause problems to humans besides the other disease-causing bacteria, which we won't talk about today. We're just going to talk about the cyanobacteria. Now, as I said, they make the water look blue-green, and they are very slimy, and sometimes have a smell that gives you sort of a musty earth smell, and that's how you can detect where they are. But I'm going to talk about cyanobacteria that are living in the ocean, and there's something called swimmer's itch.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Have you gone swimming on Long Island or any other body of water, come out of the water and felt a little itchy at times?
Probably.
Probably, because it happens to everybody. Sometimes this itchiness is caused by cyanobacteria, which are living in the water column. And what happens is, well, I'll tell you a story about what happens. I have a friend, Anita Friedenthal, who is a scientist who worked for either Nassau County Department of Health or Suffolk County Department of Health. I don't really remember. And people were complaining to the health department that there was something in the surf at Jones Beach and other beaches on Long Island, because when they came out of the water, they had red welts right at their bathing suit line. And so, of course, they went to the health department, and Anita, who was the specialist in water purity and quality, they gave her this problem to solve. And Anita captured some of these critters and looked at them, and she said that they were the larva of a tiny, tiny marine worm. But it could have also have been cyanobacteria, because there were also reports of bacteria getting on the skin, and you don't get these welts all over your body. What happens is that these critters are so small, they are microscopic, if you know about microns, microns are, or a micrometer, that's a millionth of a meter. So they're very small. And they could be one or two or three microns. They were getting caught in the bathing suit line. And the bathing suit line was acting as a net. So these critters were getting caught there underneath the bathing suit line because they're so small. And when people went home or get out of the water, they had these welts. And nobody could figure out what it was. So they gave Anita the job, and she figured out what it was. And in this case, it wasn't the cyanobacteria. But there are reports in many places around the world of itching and burning a few minutes after swimming, where even a fragment of the bacteria can cause blisters and, you know, mostly blisters and itching.
Right, that's what I was going to ask. What is the consequence of that?
Yes, the consequence of that is that. And how do you get rid of it? Well, you could take a shower with soap and water, and that'll get rid of it. Or like other contact plants that cause problems, you can use a cortisone kind of cream that you can buy over the counter now.
But it's not really invasive. It's not going to make you horribly ill.
No, unless you really get a bad stuff on them. Right. You get a lot of it on your body, then it'll make you ill.
Okay.
So these are the smallest plants in the world, and some of them affect humans in this way. So that's why I started, and now we're going to go up in size to another plant that's microscopic also, but this one is a little bit bigger. And these are part of a whole community. Carol, you know what that community is called?
Is this phytoplankton?
Yes, okay. The phytoplankton community.
Do we know what that means? I hate to throw you a curve. But
No, you can throw me a curve. I can bat some of them back. Some of them will go over the fence. So the phytoplankton community, first of all, the word phytoplankton, phytoplankton, okay? The word plankton is from a Greek word meaning wanderer.
Ah.
Plankton and the word planets are related. Like the early astronomers thought that the planets wandered all over the heavens, because in the morning they would see Jupiter here, and then in the evening it would appear to be somewhere else.
Interesting.
So that's where the word plankton came from, and plant. The word plant is in there, and the word wanderer. So phytoplankton, in the classic sense, are plants that wander. And the reason we say that about them is because they're so tiny that they can't really swim against the tides and the currents.
Hmm.
So they can't go where they want to go. If they want to go shopping, they have to take a bus. Otherwise, they can't go because they can't get to where they want to go. Some of them actually can move, but very small. Okay, and phytoplankton refers to light. Phytophotography, photons, which are particles of light energy. That's where they got their names. Okay, so...
And why should we worry about them?
Okay, we should worry about them because for many reasons. One reason is that they are at the base of the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
So who eats phytoplankton? Animal plankton called zooplankton.
Right.
Okay, and so on up the line. And who eats zooplankton? Well, the tiny little critters that live in the sea, the snails, the mussels, the clams, the scallops.
Benthic organisms.
Benthic organisms, or some tiny larva of fish and things that swim around. So why are they dangerous, these things? Okay. Because sometimes they have unconstrained growth. And there's a special word that I think we spoke about that means that they grow a lot.
Do you mean a red tide?
The red tide, okay. Or a bloom.
A bloom, right, algae bloom.
Algae bloom, because sometimes these plankton are called algae. Okay, so why are they dangerous to us? They're dangerous to us because what can happen is, I'll give you a perfect example. If you live in Florida, and you live on especially the Gulf Coast of Florida, you have to find out when you want to go swimming at the beach, whether there's a red tide. And what the red tide is, that there is so many of these phytoplankton blooming and growing in the water that they turn the water colors. And many times they turn it red or yellow or blue or other colors, indicating that there are billions and billions and billions and billions of these little plants in the water, And the reason why they are dangerous eventually to us is because all those little critters that I mentioned before, shellfish and the larvae of fish, eat these phytoplankton and take it into their system. And that's what makes them very dangerous, because eventually we're going to eat those critters. And if we eat those critters, and there's so many of these plankton in the critters, they can cause poisoning. And in the next segment, I'm going to talk about what kinds of poisoning and why these critters are so really, really dangerous.
Okay.
What kind of sicknesses would they cause?
Okay, we're back.
Okay.
You sort of left us hanging, talking about the consequences of eating organisms that have eaten the phytoplankton. So maybe we should start with some of the symptoms that we might see if we eat them by accident.
Okay, so what we like... Carol just said that we stopped when I had left you hanging about the problems with phytoplankton. Now, I'm going to give you a list of things I got from from NOAA, our agency that deals with coastal and atmospheric problems. And I have a map in front of me of North America, and it's broken down by regions. Now, our region, the Northeast region, You might say, well, if this happens in Florida, it really doesn't affect me very much unless I go to Florida. But you have to remember, a lot of the fish that we eat come from southern waters, especially fish like groupers and other fish that live around tropical reefs. If they bioaccumulate these toxins, then they're very dangerous to eat.
I like grouper. It's one of my
yes,
favorite fish.
Grouper is a terrific fish. But you have to make sure that you buy it from a reputable dealer. Don't buy it from a guy who's fishing at the end of a dock, because you never know where he caught it and when and all that stuff. So I'm going to tell you about some nasty diseases now, but I don't want you to stop eating shellfish and fin fish, because these toxic blooms are now monitored, and we can tell pretty much when the events are occurring, and they put out a warning not to eat shellfish or not to eat fin fish from these areas. So from our area... we have something called amnesiac shellfish poisoning, or ASP. And that is caused by a species of phytoplankton called Pseudonyxia. And one of these days I'll give a talk about plankton and even show you some pictures of what Pseudonyxia looks like. It's about 8 to 10 microns in size, so it's really a tiny little critter. And you can catch them in the water all the time, but They're not dangerous unless there's a bloom. Okay.
I'm interested in what happens if we eat them.
Okay, what happens if we eat them? Okay, you get memory loss.
Great.
It's pretty nasty. But luckily, it's only short-term memory loss.
I must have eaten some of those.
Yes, I think as we get older, we get that without eating them. But sometimes it could be worse than other times. But that's just one. The other kind of problem in our area, let me look this up, is DSP. Yes. Ciguatera fish poisoning. Now, this is also caused by one of these tiny microscopic little plants that if there are enough of them in the water and they bioaccumulate, then you can have something that will make you feel very strange. You'll get a temperature sensation reversal, that things that are cold will feel hot.
Hmm.
And things that are hot will feel cold, because it's really screwing up your receptors for your nervous system.
Hmm.
That's another interesting thing.
That is interesting.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, one that we've all had, probably at one time or another, if you eat a lot of shellfish or seafood, is diuretic shellfish poisoning. And
no comment.
No comment. Well, the comment is diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting.
Yeah.
So you have to be careful when you eat shellfish. And if you, as I say, if you buy the shellfish from a reputable dealer, you don't really have to worry that much, because when I lived on Long Island, I watched what the clammers do when they caught the clams. They put the clams in a sack and they label them exactly where they caught them. And then when they ship them to the dealers, so if the health department will take a sample and check out these critters to make sure they're okay. And if there ever is somebody who gets sick, they can trace back exactly which bay it came from. Like I lived in Huntington, right on Huntington Bay. I went out with one of the clammers once, and he showed me, and he said, see over here, up to this buoy, we can harvest the clams. On the other side of that buoy, we can't do it. And I said, how come? You know, it looks like right across the street. He said, because of the water currents.
Right.
One of the water currents comes from the direction of the runoff from farms. And we get too many nutrients in the water, and that makes a bloom. So that's another one. I'll just read these other ones off. But you get the idea that some of the tiniest little plants in the world are the most dangerous. Then I spoke about, yes, neurotoxin shellfish poisoning, respiratory problems. You get symptoms like you had pneumonia, that you can't breathe, and it gets into your lungs. And if you do have, not pneumonia, but what's this problem? People can't breathe. They
anaphylactic shock, you mean?
No. Like my friend Janet has it. Some kids have
asthma.
It. Asthma. Thank you, Carol. Asthma. If you have asthma, this could be especially annoying. And then there's the last one is paralytic shellfish poisoning, which can kill you. It says loss of motor control. So it attacks your whole nervous system. All right? So these sound like very nasty little plants.
I'm wondering how I survived. I grew up when we had a boat on Long Island Sound, and my mother loved clams. We used to tread for clams,
right?
And Half Moon
use
Beach and Sands Point. Yeah, yes. You used to wiggle around with your feet, and we'd take the clams back to the dock at night and open them, and everybody would eat them.
Yes. Now, how many years ago was that, Tara?
A lot of years ago.
Okay. Two things. First of all, the time you're talking about, there were many less people living along the shoreline, and there were less nutrients being put into the water. And by nutrients, I mean fertilizing lawns, farmers, and defective sewage treatment plants. They put many nutrients in the water, mostly nitrates and phosphates, and the diatoms thrive on that, and it makes them grow rapidly. And the way they grow rapidly, it's very simple. They divide in half. They do binary fission, is it called, when the cells just divide. Mm-hmm. So if you have one diatom cell, in 24 hours you can probably have, I don't know, exponentially, they keep dividing
a lot.
So that's part of the problem. And the other thing is that years ago, if you got a little sick from eating these clams occasionally or something, nobody thought much of them, because, you know, maybe you got a stomach ache once in a while,
It's interesting. We didn't eat mussels because we felt that mussels were poisonous. Mussels were all over the place in Long Island Sound, but we never ate them. But we felt the clams were okay.
Yeah, well, the mussels are just as good as the clams. It's true. When I lived on Long Island, too, hardly anybody ate mussels, except Italians or Portuguese people who lived on the island. They would collect them. And when I lived out in Huntington, there was a certain spot that was great for mussels with good circulation of water. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mussels are so much cheaper than clams and delicious with a garlic white wine sauce. Right. You know, they're really great. And with a lot of bread to sup up.
You can get we know a place where you can get all you can eat mussels. It's wonderful.
Okay. So just a positive word for plankton. Even though they are dangerous, they're not always dangerous. Sometimes you can have a bloom where they're growing very rapidly and they fill up the waters. And these particular phytoplankton don't have toxins in them that they produce. But what they do is they produce so many of themselves that they cause eutrophication of the water. That means they use up all the oxygen in the water. And the critters that can leave, like the fish and the crabs, they can leave. But the benthic organisms like mussels, and then clams and oysters, they really can't go anywhere. Because once they attach to the bottom, they're sessile, they don't go anywhere. So most of the times, you don't have to worry, except, as I said, you buy from a reputable fish store, a reputable dealer, and don't buy from a guy who I used to see on Long Island with a truck on the side of the road selling, 100 clams for $10 or something like that. Because you don't know where he got them from, and it could be dangerous. Okay, also one last positive thing about phytoplankton are that since they are plants, they do photosynthesis. And remember you all learned in school about photosynthesis and how important it is?
Right.
And what do we get from photosynthesis? We get
energy.
Yeah, the plants use the sun's energy to do it, and they use up carbon. And they give off oxygen.
Right.
So we take a deep breath and we let the air out. We can say, thank you, plankton, because between the cyanobacteria that live in the water that also do it and the plankton that live in the water, they estimate they supply 50% of the oxygen we breathe. And the other oxygen is supplied by the green plants on the land, trees, shrubs, and all that kind of stuff. So the oxygen that we use, we get from these planktonic animals, mostly diatoms, and those cyanobacteria that I mentioned before. And someday I'll tell you the history of cyanobacteria. They actually, way back 2.5 billion years ago, they changed conditions on Earth. So at that time, most of the life on Earth was in the seas, and they produced so much oxygen that it bubbled out of the seas, and critters could move out of the water onto the land. So we think that they had a big part in the life. So, but that's another story for another day.
Very good.
So now we're going to talk about some more, as I call, dangerous plants. Now, and
okay, we're back. Bernie mentioned something about the Little Shop of Horrors. I'm very curious what that was about.
Yes, we have that in our notes. And I didn't tell Carol why I put it in our notes. But if you remember the play or the movie about the Little Shop of Horrors, it was this store that sold these wild plants. And the plants were person-eating plants. I don't want to say man-eating plants, so I'll say person-eating plants.
Well, carnivorous. Carnivorous. That's non-sexist.
Carnivorous plants. Right. So the name of that movie was Little Shop of Horrors. Now, there's a place in the world that I call the Big Shop of Horrors, and it's Australia. Now, if you folks have been to Australia, you know it's a great place to visit. They really love Americans. So it's a very comfortable, easy country to visit. Everybody speaks English, even though sometimes with the accent, it's hard to understand what they're talking about. But if you order a beer, they'll know what you're talking about, and it's a very great place to visit. Except Australia is the home of a few of critters that I'm going to mention now. Australia claims to have the most poisonous snake in the world. It has the most poisonous spiders in the world. Now, what does this have to do with plants? Well, we're going to get that in a minute. And it's also the world's most painful plant lives in Australia. And it's called the stinging tree.
Wow.
Now, I personally had an experience, but luckily I didn't get stung by the tree. When I was hiking years ago, when I traveled to Australia, I was doing the backpacker route, and I stayed in a beautiful backpacker's lodge in Queensland, which is the northern part of Australia, where there's a huge rainforest. And there's a national park called Kakadu National Park, which is a tropical, beautiful rainforest area, because you have to realize the further north you go in Australia, the warmer it is, because it's in the southern hemisphere. Mm. So you're going towards the equator. Like here, the further north we go, it gets colder and colder. We're going towards the North Pole. But in Australia, the furthest north you go, you end up in Queensland, and you end up in the tropical rainforest. So I checked into this lodge, and it was at the beginning of the rainy season, and it had just started to rain. But right before I checked in, I looked in front of this lodge. There was a cage, like a wild animal cage, like if you had chickens or something, or other critters. It was made out of a very fine mesh, and it had a big sign on it: dangerous, poisonous plant. Don't even think of coming near it. So I said, oh, well, I've seen poisonous plants before in the United States, but I guess they know what they're talking about. So I went in, and then they scheduled a little hike through the rainforest to talk about the plants and the animals. And we came out, and I said, tell me about this poisonous plant. He said, well, we call it the stinging tree. I said, how come? He said, well, first of all, let me tell you the name of it. The scientific name is Gimpy Gimpy.
That's easy to remember.
That's the common name. The scientific name is Dendronycin motoritis, which is the most painful of all trees. And it has five related shrubs in Australia that are the same, but this is the worst one. Okay, so even though these trees don't hunt in packs like wolves, they are pretty vicious. And how are they vicious? Okay. You know, many plants on their surface have hairs and thorns and other things to keep other critters from eating them. Well, the stinging tree has thorns, but they're microscopic. You can't see them. And they're made of silica. And silica is what glass is made out of. So these thorns are made out of glass. And they are like hypodermic needles. They're hollow, and they come to a very sharp point, and they're very small. And the woman who did research on these plants, I'll read to you how she could handle it. Her name was Dr. Hurley. She found the only way she could handle the leaves safely without getting stung was to wear incredibly thick and bulky welding gloves. Now, if you've ever seen somebody welding, they have these really, really heavy gloves because they have to protect their hands from the sparks from the welding or from the liquid hot metal. These silicon hairs that are on the surface of the plant penetrate your skin, and then they break off. Okay? They're so tiny that often the skin will close over them. Mm. Okay? Sometimes, once you're stung, you can't remove the stinging hairs. So she wore these gloves, and the silicon hairs cause pain, and they carry a neurotoxin.
But why would they put the plant in a cage? Why wouldn't they just put a sign that says, stay away from this plant?
Because you can't even get close to it. If you get close to this plant and there's a breeze, there's some wind, the wind will break off some of these micro hairs or needles, or hypodermic needles, as I call them, and can blow against your skin, or you can inhale it in your nose, and for some reason your nose will start to kill you, and it will start to bleed if you rub your nose. So you can see why this plant is so dangerous. Okay, so what she had to do was to wear a respirator mask that's for toxic situations. So this is how she had to get dressed. Cover her body up, wear welder's gloves to handle it, and wear a respirator that will filter out these almost microscopic particles from her face. So she did research, and she showed that it's not the silicon hairs that really do damage to you. It's the toxin that they carry. They carry this toxin, and it's a very stable toxin. So you can activate it by just touching your skin. So let's say that you're walking along and you feel something on your skin and you start rubbing it. That breaks those needles up and makes them shoot the toxin into your body. So experiments have done with hairs, and it's such a stable toxin that they've had these hairs stowed away in a lab for a century. And they took it and the toxin was still viable. So you can see why I put this in my talk as one of the most dangerous trees around, called the stinging tree from Australia.
Do they have a lot of these trees in Australia?
They try not to. Now, the interesting thing about these trees, besides how nasty they are, is that the animals that are indigenous to Australia, like deer and foxes maybe, or other animals, the toxin doesn't bother them. So here's this example of coevolution, where this plant evolved with these nasty, nasty things to protect themselves, and the countermeasures are from the mammals and the other animals that have developed resistance to this toxin. But, when Australia was settled, they brought in a lot of critters that were not indigenous. They brought in cattle. And there's a big problem. So if you have a cattle ranch, you have to go around your cattle ranch all the time to make sure that these plants are not growing because, the seeds are dispersed by the wind, and it could grow anywhere along trails, along roadways, anywhere there's an opening in the rainforest and it can get sunlight, the plant will thrive. So if cattle are grazing and they happen to graze on this plant, they don't know that it's poisonous. They can't tell it has toxins in it. And if they get those needles stuck in their nose or their tongue or their throat, they will go crazy trying to get rid of it. So what they'll run is, and they'll butt their heads against something just to try to get rid of it. And a lot of times they die. They kill themselves.
Is it lethal? I was going to ask you, does it end up being lethal?
Well, for the cattle, it can, because they go crazy. And they'll, trying to get rid of it, they'll run against a stone wall to try to get rid of it. Mm. Otherwise, it's not lethal. It just really burns the hell out of you. It's a really terrible sensation. Luckily, I didn't have that close
away
a thing.
From it.
Yes, it drives cattle crazy. So that's also one of the strange things about this plant. And that was a really nasty plant. And that's why I put it into my talk. And if you should still go to Australia. It's a great place to go.
I was just going to say, it's pretty discouraging.
No.
But we should still consider it.
Yes, it's a great plant to go. But my advice is, if you go there and you take a hike, go with a naturalist. Because they know what to show you to stay away from. Okay, we're going to stop now. And remember, this is a National Heritage Radio brought to you by TechServe. And we're broadcasting from Roberta's lovely restaurant in downtown Bushwick.